Hello, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the expert voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello.
I'm calling you the expert now, mate.
I'll take that. Fantastic news.
We've moved on.
We've kicked up. I feel like I've progressed to the next level.
Well, your analysis has been very good in recent weeks, so hopefully you're going to keep that up today.
Fingers crossed. You never know. Stranger things have happened.
We'll move straight on to some correspondence.
Let's do it.
Mate, and again, apologies to those who sent your emails in. We are getting through them, but sometimes when we get a topical email or a tweet, and I say topical, I mean that with regards to who we've interviewed on the show, they do have to take priority. Now, this has come from last week's podcast with Jimmy Walker, where he mentioned that he would take care of his own transfers. Mm. Alec Chamberlain also mentioned this in a previous podcast where he said that he didn't have an agent in those days. What's it like now? Because we've had a lot of people come in and say, well, do players still not have agents? Mm. Is it just something that's been from the past?
They all have agents now. And the reason is, and the one simple reason is that it has changed. So for these guys, they mentioned they didn't have an agent. The actual negotiation part isn't overly difficult. You know, ordinarily you'll go in. Let's say you're at a club and you're going to do a renegotiation. They would have an offer for you and you would go in, and more often than not, you'd sign it. But the problem is, if you don't have an agent, you don't have any leverage. What I mean by that is, let's say you're going in to sign that renegotiation, you don't have an agent, you won't know if any other clubs like you or any other clubs might want to sign you. What that means is you've got no real argument to say to the club, I deserve to be paid more. So you'll ordinarily go in, they'll give you the ordinary story and say, we cannot go higher than this, this is our very best offer, take it or leave it. And ultimately you end up signing it. And I did it once without an agent, and that's exactly what happened. What then happens if you do have an agent and they're doing their job properly is they know what's going on in the market. They know what clubs are looking for keepers. They know what clubs like you as a goalkeeper. And now all of a sudden, if it comes to a renegotiation, but you know that there's another club in a division higher maybe that would give you more money, then of course you'd say to your club, okay, I'm okay at the moment, I'm going to run down my contract. At which point, what will they do? Well, they might then say, oh, we'll give you a bit more money. And then you say, no, oh, we'll give you a bit more money. And that's how you see so many goalkeepers maximise their earning potential, because they know they've got other options. The problem of not having an agent is it's very difficult to know what those other options are.
So is this just something that's developed over the years? Because you hear a lot of older players. I remember hearing Niall Quinn saying that he always did his own deals, never had to deal with an agent and someone else sort of blurring the lines of your move. Alec Chamberlain more so, but Jimmy Walker only quit playing a few years back.
Yeah, true. I mean, look, you can do it without an agent, but consider that for a start, are you going to go in and do your own negotiation? Like, could that be a little bit awkward as a player? Do you have the knowledge that you might need, as many lawyers do that do a lot of these contracts, to the fine detail that goes into the contracts? What about the different clauses that are into the contracts? And the small print, you know, there's always stuff. And by the way, clubs, they're not that innocent. They might put something in the small print which could trip you up at some point. What happens if you get relegated? What happens if you get promoted? What are your regular bonuses? All these details as well, they're the bits that maybe agents don't get the credit for. A good agent, and I say good because there's a lot of bad ones, there are some good ones, the good ones will take care of all that, and they'll know where they can push. They'll know what the landscape is at that particular club so that they can then get you the very best deal at that particular club. And there's so much more that does come into it. But for me, the day-to-day stuff might be getting you in the press, improving your brand, improving your PR. It might be speaking to a lot of the clubs to find out which hit list you're on, just to know where you are in the market. And that's where I think an agent for a reasonably small percentage, which is ordinarily paid by the club, makes a lot more sense. But I go back to my initial point, it needs to be a good agent, because there are so many out there that have a bad name. So certainly if you're a professional goalkeeper listening to this, do your due diligence before you make any decision on an agent. But I would advise getting an agent.
Just very quickly, I'd imagine this is going to be a really simple answer. Is there any difference with an agent dealing with a goalkeeper to an agent dealing with an outfield player?
I think so, for the fact that an agent that looks after goalkeepers, ordinarily you have to be in touch with a lot of goalkeeper coaches, because a lot of goalkeeper coaches, certainly Championship, League One, League Two, are making decisions as to what happens in their goalkeeper department. And I think we're going to see that more and more, that as we see in a lot of the clubs now, they're being segregated in such a way where you've got medical department, recruitment department, fitness department, etc., etc. There will now be, and there are a few clubs, a goalkeeping department where the manager won't be this overarching, looking after everything, choosing all the players. He will then consult with his goalkeeper coach or goalkeeping team to then say, who is our next goalkeeper we're bringing in?
Mate, you sound like you know your stuff.
Maybe I do.
I'm impressed.
Thank you.
Thank you for the answer. Hopefully the listeners enjoyed it. And remember, if you've got a question you'd like to put to Rich, just let us know on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official. Just search GK Union on Facebook, or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. This week's guest is a man best known for his 13-year spell with Chelsea. In the late 80s, he helped the club rise from the second tier back to the top echelons of English football and was part of squads that won three major trophies in 2 years at the back end of the 1990s. He's also a man Gianluca Vialli once described as a lad that everybody loves. Kevin Hitchcock, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thank you.
Fair statement that from Vialli, Kev?
Yeah, lovely.
Well, look, there's no better place to start than welcome you properly as the man that made Richard Lee.
That was hard work, by the way.
Look, Hitch, I brought you on to say some nice words.
I will, but let's get rid of the worst of it. He wouldn't listen at the beginning.
Do you know what? I remember it well. It was obviously when Vialli came in, and it was a really interesting time that, actually, because I hadn't really ever had proper goalkeeper coaching, but you coming into Watford for that period of time, and as much as a lot of Watford fans won't remember the Vialli era maybe all that positively, for me personally, and obviously getting to know Gianluca, but getting to know yourself, it was a really interesting year, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was good. It was my first intro into coaching. And to be honest with you, when I first went, I was a little bit nervous how the players would react, how the goalkeepers react. But I tried to make it really entertaining, really enjoyable, funny, but hard. It was hard.
Yeah, it was hard.
And you probably agree with that, Rich.
It was hard, yeah. No, I remember, I still have nightmares about some of the drills, Hitch.
You had a six-pack, though.
That's true. I don't have that anymore. I think we need to start working together again.
Get their abs going again.
Yeah,
no problem.
About it.
Well, Kevin, it's no secret the man alongside me likes to occasionally brag about his ability to save penalties. Today he has company, doesn't he? I had no idea you were also partial to saving penalties. You had a pretty good record over the years.
I had a better than pretty good record. There's one manager now playing his trade in League One who was a top Premier League player. I saved three of his penalties in one game.
Really? Who was that?
Nigel Clough.
I've got to ask you, because we get the listeners thankfully are going up every week, which is great. We get a lot of young goalkeepers, a lot of goalkeeper coaches, but certainly for the young goalkeepers who are facing penalties week in, week out, what was your strategy?
Back in the day, my strategy was every programme I could get hold of, every television clip I could get hold of, I watched people taking penalties. And it was quite difficult when I was at Mansfield, it was difficult. But I used to look at even the team's programmes, pictures, and I used to look at anything. And I would pick the side I was going, and I like to think I used a technique where I was going to get there as quick as I can, as late as possible. And that's what I coach even today.
It's quite interesting watching some of those penalties back on YouTube, because you see a lot of keepers now and they use all the histrionics and they move around and they chuck their arms up in the air.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
on the most part, it seemed like you stayed quite still.
Yeah, I don't go for all that putting people off, because you'll end up with egg on your face someday and people just laugh at you. So I used to try to keep low profile. I did all my homework on every player. Once I did make my mind up to go a certain way, that was me going. And I had managers later on at Chelsea, and if it was a penalty shootout, if I was on the bench, they were going to bring me on to go for the penalties, because they knew my record in penalties was I'd always save two or three, always.
It was a good job Kepa wasn't playing when you were on the bench then. Did you say...
He was definitely coming off. I'd drag him off myself.
Did you say three penalties in one game from Nigel Clough there?
Yeah, what it was, I was at Mansfield at the time, and we were playing Forest in a cup called the Notts County Cup, which still goes. There's only three teams. And the day before, I went over to... I was living in a village called Keyworth with my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time. And we bumped into Brian Clough, and he said to me, "Young man, we're going to put £5 new tomorrow." And we played the game, and Nigel had a penalty against me in the game, and I saved it. And the referee said I moved, took it again, and I saved it again. And then it went to a penalty shootout. He was first up, and I saved it again.
Well, that was the start of pretty good things to come with Mansfield, because you were the hero, weren't you, in the EFL Trophy, what was called the Freight Rover Trophy back then.
Yeah, right. And the year before, we got beat in the area final by Wigan on penalties, and I saved two penalties in that one as well.
Well, it's interesting when you look at the pattern, isn't it? Because you stopped Kerry Dixon from scoring a hat-trick in a League Cup game for Mansfield against Chelsea. You then moved to Chelsea and saved successive penalties, I believe, in your opening few games. There was one against Liverpool from Peter Beardsley where the commentator actually said, it could be the most important save of his life.
It was a ridiculous penalty. It was a joke. But I guessed right. I went to my right. I did favour my right side. If I was going to save a penalty early on in my career, it was always to my right.
Why was that? Was that just a technical thing?
I was stronger with my right. Everybody's got a stronger side. Mm. And mine was the right. But I worked hard, really hard on my left, even as a young boy. So I'd do extra. And I used to do it with young goalkeepers as well.
Going back to that time, did you have a goalkeeper coach back then?
I had a part-time goalkeeper coach, Peter Bonetti.
Do you know what? He did the rounds because he was doing part-time at Watford as well for a long time. But that's what it used to be. In fact, I was talking to Mervyn Day about this recently, and I know he had four or five clubs that he would go in a day a week at different clubs. It's amazing to think that, and that wasn't that long ago really, that you'd only get, what was it, a day a week, 2 days a week?
My first full-time coach at Chelsea would have been Eddie Neddy, 1996-97, when Rudolik became manager.
Wow.
Because Glenn only had him as reserve team coach, and they'd do a little bit. Glenn used to do a bit with us. Me, Dimitri and Bez, and a couple of the kids. And that was how I really got into the coaching, because I used to take the younger ones, help the younger ones, like Lenny Pidgley, Nick Colgan. I used to look after them.
So Glenn Hoddle used to act as a goalkeeper coach, you're saying?
Glenn thought he was a goalkeeper. By the way, he was probably one of the best managers I've ever worked with.
Yeah. What, in terms Glenn, of attention to detail? Or?
Unbelievable. He changed, when he came to Chelsea, he changed the slightest things into big. He used to take the balls in the sauna and make sure they were correct weight.
Really?
Yeah, he used to do little things like that. Although he did go a bit far on one time. We had this, a woman came in who was a arm wrestling champion. And she put us on this diet, so no one would do it. And we ended up, we played Forest, and no one would have pre-match because what the food was on offer. Really? So we scrapped it the following week.
It's quite interesting, though, because I always remember a couple of managers that I've had that they'll try and think of things outside of the box in order to change things up and keep people guessing a little bit. Was it more that? It was just trying to create something to challenge the players?
Glenn was always a bit stubborn, and he was always a leader in different coaching aspects. But he got a few things wrong, in my opinion. And that was one of them. He brought this reflexologist in early on, and I wasn't into it at all. And he had this great big poster on the wall of a foot and the body, and it was all colour-coded. And then he'd tickle your toe on one foot and then press it hard on, and then he'd say, "There's the problem." And I'd go, "Really? Really?" So I never bought into it, and I was a senior player at the time, and a couple of senior pros terrorised him, so he didn't last too long.
It's funny because you speak to a lot of ex-pros now, or you hear a lot of ex-pros say that Glenn Hoddle, had it not been for a few words that he said in the media, would still be England manager because they were so impressed with his methods.
100%. And by the way, he was player manager at the time, and he was so good, you know. I've got on really well with Glenn. He liked the way I worked. You know, I didn't always play, but I never gave him a problem. I was always grateful for Glenn for what he helped me with at Chelsea.
Well, another character that you worked with for a brief spell, you mentioned him back then, was Brian Clough. Now, he plucked you from non-league when you were at Barking. What was that like, going to Nottingham Forest and working with Brian Clough?
Incredible. So the story of me going to Nottingham, his chief scout at the time was a guy called Alan Hill. And he wrote to every non-league club in the country, "If you had any players worth watching, let us know and we'll go and watch them." And they came down and watched me play at Hitchin. Alan came down. And a week later, I was asked to go on a month's trial to Forest. The first game I played a reserve game at Bolton. And I'm sitting in the dressing room, and I was sitting next to Colin Todd, Larry Lloyd. I was sitting next to Viv Anderson, John Robertson, Peter Davenport. They was all playing in the first team, but he made them play in the reserves. And then the first touch of the ball I had, it was an icy night, and it ball bounced. It was on one of them tangos, and a ball bounced over my head, and I got back and saved it. And I was sitting down in the dressing room at half time. I thought, this ain't going to go well. And as I was going out for the second half, he come up to me and absolutely punched me on the arm and turned around and said, "Young man, you're here because you're bloody as good as these. Now get out there and show me what you can do." And it was the best thing that happened to me. He was really good to me.
So you referenced it there. Eventually you moved on to Chelsea. Now, we had Dave Besson on the podcast a few weeks back, and he spoke a lot about his time there. And there was that really interesting period where both of you were fighting for the number one jersey. There was one season in particular where you played an equal amount of games, 21 league games apiece. You were both in and out throughout the campaign.
Yeah, I got injured early in the season in the Championship then, second division then. And I was in and out, I got back in, and then I played a game and I got a bad back pass from Graham Lasso, and I dived at someone's feet. It was at Tottenham. I done me cruciate, and that was me out for the rest of the season. That was in the January, and I was out for 6-7 months with that. And that's the day I had the operation. I came out and they come to see me. Bobby Campbell and Gwyn Williams come to see me at my house, and they was, you know, see how I was. They went up and signed Dave Besant that night.
And there was that interesting incident where Ian Porterfield said that Besant would never play for the club again. How was it from your perspective? Was it a bit of an odd time?
Oh, it's disgraceful. I mean, we played, that was the day we played Norwich, and I was out of contract. And them times, you carried on training and playing, but you was out of contract. I looked like I was leaving, and I was sitting in a stand with a good friend of mine, and I was sitting on the front row, just above the dugout, on the middle tier. And Dave had his mishap. He let a couple of bags, I think they were two and a half as well. Soon you're up and they lost 3-2. And when the third one went in, they absolutely crucified him. And then they started singing my name, which was embarrassing. And I remember going home, and the first thing I did when I went home, I phoned Dave, spoke to him, and, you know, because he's always been a good friend. We've been really close. And as one door closes, another one opens for someone else. It's always the way. And then when Ian Porterfield said that, he came to me on the Monday and wanted me to play the following week. And at that time, I had a bit of a shoulder injury as well. And I was out of contract. I said, listen, I ain't going to play unless I get a contract. So I was out of contract at the time. And I had my first baby as well at the time. So I needed a bit of security. And I said, I'm not playing. I'm not playing until you give me a contract. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, you play against Man City on Sky on the Sunday. If you do well, get a new contract. We played Man City. We won 1-0 and I had a weldy. I went to Main Road and I always had a weldy. And it was live on Sky, and then 2 days later I signed a 4-year contract.
Wow.
So that was during... So that's the first Premier League season, right? So that's during the season, as the season's going on, you were out of contract, but you were still at Chelsea.
Yeah. That was in September, I think.
Well, the contract's very different then. I take it, was it not like a standard year-to-year contract? This
was Paul Bosman.
So
the clubs had all the power.
Right.
There was also that season. Now, this is always about positivity for goalkeepers. We are the Goalkeepers Union. But if I was to say to you, Hitchcock's Halloween Horror, would that spark any memories?
Did I get sent off?
It was a headline. And it's interesting, because of what had happened with Dave Besson, it was the game against Sheffield United, the Brian Dean goal, when you came out.
The back
part.
Remember Barry Davis, the commentator?
Yeah.
That was match of the day then. He slaughtered me. But I don't think he liked me anyway. And he wanted me to do an interview after, and I wouldn't do it. Yeah. Just to ridicule me. Was it Little John? The guy called Little John took the ball.
Adrian Little John took it off, and then crossed it in for Brian Dean. I think it came off the post, and then Dean just whacked it in from a yard. Why do you think he didn't like you, Barry Davis?
If ever a goal went in, he was very, very critical. John Motson was brilliant. Brian Moore was brilliant. Martin Tyler was always brilliant. But Barry Davis was always... I got the impression he didn't like me, and he was always critical.
So this time, if we talk about your time at Chelsea, there's a whole load to cover, but you obviously arrived in 88. There was a huge changing of the guard during your
third... Oh, my God. Unbelievable. You know, when I first went to that club, I went there in 88. First week, we stayed in a hotel. We used to stay at Burnham Beaches. And they roomed me with Mickey Hazard. Mick was like a bit of a legend, good player with the ball. Without the ball, a nightmare, and no one really spoke to him. We carried on this ritual where we'd stay in a hotel, and we were struggling. We ended up going down, and there'd be two groups, two factions. There'd be Kerry Dixon, Joe McLaughlin, and Mickey Hazard, and in the other quarter there'd be Steve Wicks, Steve Clark, Tony Dorigo, and Gordon Dewey, and they hated each other. And it was the biggest reason why we got relegated, because they didn't respect each other.
How does a manager deal with that when you've got factions of players that don't get on?
just he let it go. He was one of these managers who tried to bully everybody. He used to belittle people left, right and centre. He wasn't a very good manager. But that's another story. And, you know, it wasn't till 2 years later things started to change. And I'll always say, my hand on my heart, that it started to change when the people came in of the quality of Andy Tandon, Daniel Swise and Vinnie Jones. And how our club went from fractions to everybody together, and I was part of that, and I it was a turning of the club where a couple of players came in and everybody got together. Plus, then players left, and then the young players were coming up who wanted to be a part of the club anyway. People like Graham Stewart, Jason Cundy, David Lee, Frank Sinclair, Eddie Newton, all young boys who come up through the youth team, and all of a sudden it became a family club right the way to our left in 2001.
How was that working with Dennis Wise and Vinnie Jones at the same time?
Fantastic. Vinnie wasn't scared of anybody apart from Dennis.
Well, I can just imagine training just being a laugh every day with those two.
Oh, unbelievable. He used to do things. We went on a trip to Spain once. Vinnie was one of these characters. I lived in Hemel at the time and Vinnie lived around a corner. And we only had one car, so my wife had the car. And then he picked me up one morning to go to the airport, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, so it was pitch black. I've opened the door. He drove on the big green in front of where I lived, and I opened the door, and he had the brightest clothes on you'd ever seen in your life. That was Vinny. Proper character.
Well, eventually, those guys moved on, and I mean, Dennis Wise stayed along with you and Steve Clark and Frank Sinclair. But then this new wave came in. You're talking Dan Petrescu, Gianluca Vialli, Gianfranco Zola, obviously Rude Hullett came in as well. But you stayed, remained a constant.
I tried to leave when Glenn made Dimitri number one. I had chances to go on loan to Celtic, I had chances to go on loan to Rangers. I had a chance to go to Wolves. Someone rang me up to go to Wolves. By then, the club wouldn't let me go. Why they wouldn't let me know, I never got told the reason. Maybe because what I did behind the scenes. I really don't know. I'd like to think it was that I was part of their family with Ken Bates as well.
Mm. Well, do you know, on that note, the amount of goalkeepers that did come in during your time there, and several that did come in ahead of you, were there any times, you know, the likes of Dimitri Karin, Ed Dehoy, Grodas, these guys coming, were there ever times when you saw someone coming in and you had that thought that I know that I'm better than them?
Yeah, all the time. All the time. Even when Dave came in, I wanted to prove I was better than him. Dimitri was really good, but he had a flaw. He always sort of missed away games at big clubs like Leeds, Newcastle, Man United, Liverpool. I seem to get them games.
What was the reason for that?
All sorts of reasons. Injuries. We played a FA Cup game and they played Newcastle and Dimitri gave away a goal in the last minute. The lads had a little pop at him, and then we were training 2 days later and Glenn was taking me and him. John Spencer turned around and said to me, I bet you play next Wednesday. I bet you play in the replay. I bet he don't play. And we trained, me and Dimitri trained with Glenn, and he pulled up with an injury. And I just started laughing because all I wanted to do was play football.
Do you know what? That's obviously, I know this from, you know, knowing you as long as I did, and how, like, psychologically you're so strong. Like, you're always, you just put yourself up for everything and not scared of anything. But do you think with something like that where it becomes almost a bit more than a coincidence, that it might have just been maybe a bit of fear from him?
Yeah. All day. I think one of the hardest things I did was the very first time I came on as sub. I found that hard. But once I touched the ball, then I was fine.
What was your mind? I always go into the mindset stuff because I'm fascinated by it and everyone's so different. And meeting, well, in fact, obviously you took me up to Blackburn, got to meet Brad Friedel. And knowing him, and he's one I always go back to because such a level head all the time. You never down, never up, just kind of. What was your, did you have a strategy or is it just the way you are, do you think?
I'm a fighter, Rich. And I fight my corner and I wanted to prove. And I love football. I love playing. I mean, the best thing about football is playing. It's a drug, and I just loved it, and I just enjoyed it. And the bigger the stadium, the better I seemed to hold no fear. And the first time I went to Anfield, I heard all these stories. Oh, it was just really, really frightening going to play in Anfield. You run up to the Kop End, and they give you the best reception any club could give you. And it made me feel 10 foot tall. I loved it. Man United, always wanted to go to Man United and play at Old Trafford. If you're doing well after about 20 minutes, they're booing their team.
Just sticking on Chelsea and that changing of the guard, I'm quite interested to know what it was like seeing that transition and working with all these foreign imports. You said it changed the dressing room. What was it like culturally working with so many different nationalities?
We just treated them as we treated anybody else. You know, they mixed in with everybody and people come in and followed suit. And then we had the likes of Frank Leboeuf coming in, who could be a bit up himself sometimes, and he had to be told, you know, you've got to toe the line, otherwise, you know, we ain't going to be happy, which was what happened to him. And then you've got people like Di Matteo coming in, who just wanted to be part of the British culture. And then Zola came in. I thought all Italians were well-dressed, smart, and this scruffy little Sardinian come in with a mop of hair and couldn't speak a word of English. And he later told me, when he came in, Rudolik told him, all the English lads like to play golf, so you better learn to play golf. He went away in this little studio in London and learnt to play golf. He didn't come out to play for at least 7 months. And when he came out to play, he was about 18 handicap.
Wow.
And then he asked me to go to Sardinia to, you know, play golf and get the families together. He'd leave his wife and kids with my wife Fiona and the kids. No one could speak Italian, no one could speak English, but they got on really well. And they become our family. Yeah. And when we was in Sardinia, we'd go and play golf, and then he'd all of a sudden come down. I'd be off 7 or 8 at the time, 6, 7, 8, and he came down from 10 to 7, and then we're off level. So for teaching him to play golf and helping him, now he's the other way around. Now he's off 2.
Wow. What are you off these days, Itch?
My official handicap is 8.
Very good.
We had Jimmy Walker on the podcast, and he said that at... That's all you need. You just need the name. Yeah. That's all you need to laugh.
Can I tell you a little story about him?
Please do,
yeah.
Right, so I went on this coaching course up at Lillishaw. Walsall were training there. I didn't know he was from Mansfield. I just looked at this young goalie come up to me and he starts, Kevin Hitchcock, what a legend. I was, he's taking the mick out of me. He's taking the mick. But he's from Mansfield and he used to come and watch me play all the time. So I'm one of his heroes, just from my Mansfield days.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah. He told us that even as a manager, when he was at West Ham, Gianfranco Zola was manager for a short period, that even as a manager on the training ground, he could have still been playing. So I can't imagine what it must have been like when he was a player on the training ground.
Oh, incredible. Incredible. He changed goalkeeper. He got rid of Ludo. I don't know what the problem was. He got rid of Ludo. And I was just left Man City. I was out of work. And he phoned me and asked me to go and help him. And I said, I'd love to, but I need to ask Mark first. So I rang Sparky up. And Sparky said, I wouldn't let you go and work for anyone else apart from him because he's your mate. So me and my wife went down and lived with him for 3 or 4 months. And I see it, and I told him, you've got to stop training because you're embarrassing them. You can do things they can't do. He is my best friend in football. And to work with him as closely as I did, I thought it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. And we learned things about each other, which was nice.
Just a couple more bits on Chelsea. Is it true that Ruud Gullit once gave you a bit of a dressing down on the pitch?
Yes, yes, yes. We played, it was just after Matthew Harding had died. We played Tottenham and there was a long throw at the Matthew Harding end and I come out and called. I got a tangle with Dupes and Teddy Sheringham and they scored. And he came in and smashed the ball in the net and said something in Dutch. I won't tell you what he said. I shouted something back in English and at half time, I stormed off at the pitch at half time and I went for him. And he went in the back room with Graham Ricks. And I sat there, and then Rixie came out, and I said, let me at him, let me at him, he ain't doing that to me. Rixie sort of calmed me down, and he said, you just go out there and show him what you can do. And I had a weldy second half, we ended up winning.
Just on that, how do you feel about that? Because I see it's not obviously, it's quite a regular occurrence when you see players, like a goalkeeper will make a mistake, and it can go one or two ways. Either the lads all turn their back and are talking to themselves as they walk away. You'll then sometimes get one or two will come and like pat you on the back and almost try and tell the fans, look, it's his fault, not our fault. Like, I don't know, how did you deal with it? How do you think it should be dealt with?
It's up to me. I know I made a mistake. I don't need people telling me I made a mistake. And what I used to do all the time, things like that, if someone said something to me, that it used to happen in training a lot. And I would, you know what I was like, I would say, hang on a minute, you just give the ball away six times, pull your finger out. Yeah. You know, that was it. You know you made a mistake. Yeah. You don't need people telling you. What I used to do as well, if I did make a mistake, I'd say, listen, guys, sorry I messed up, but I'll make it up. And that's how I did it. As soon as I made a mistake, I'll hold my hand up. I made a few mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, but you can't let it affect you. You've got to dust yourself down and go again and prove the next thing you do is the best thing, because there's nothing you can do about what's just gone.
So that game was Spurs, who were also the opponents for your final ever game for Chelsea in 1999. By the way, I don't know whether you're aware, this game is available on YouTube. The entire 90 minutes of that game is available on YouTube, but the commentary is in Chinese. So if you want to...
Ginola scored when I was routed to the spot.
That's the one.
I only knew I was playing an hour before the kickoff there.
What was the reason for that?
Ed was ill. I don't think Ed DuBois was ill.
Yeah, it just reminded me of, and this is where I know Matt obviously touched on it at the start of the show, is that you're my first proper goalkeeper coach. You know, I worked with you for however many years, and obviously I made my debut when you were coach, and I'll always remember that. You say about finding out an hour before. I tell this story over and over about I only found out give or take an hour before, but you knew on the Saturday. There was a game on the Tuesday against Preston, and because we were having a bit of a cup run, they obviously gave me the game on the Tuesday, but you knew on the Saturday, didn't you?
Yep.
And you told my entire family, so they then booked a box. Yep. But the reason I remember it is that, you know, I'd always come in on a Sunday, and obviously you were always obviously about working hard, but at the same time making sure we enjoyed ourselves and lived our lives and what have you. So it'd often be coming in on a Sunday and telling you stories from the night out and what have you. But I'll always remember that particular one where I came in, and I think Neil Ardley had taken me out on the Saturday night. And I'll always remember it because I came in on the Sunday and I was buzzing. It was a fun night. And I went to tell you about it, and I could see you were quite disappointed. And it only clicked afterwards that it was because you knew I was going to make my debut.
And the other story to that, which not many people know, Ray Lou was manager, wasn't he?
That's right.
We had Ray Lou, Terry Burton and Nigel Gibbs, and Ray asked me whether you'd be ready enough to play.
Yeah.
And I went 100%. He won't let you down, he'll do this. Don't worry about this. He'll come and catch cross here, he'll kick it here, he'll make saves. Yeah, he might make the odd mistake. And Terry Burton said, well, you know, it's not your job on the line, is it? I went, yeah, it is. And him and Nigel Gibbs weren't really keen on changing. So, and I put it to Ray Lou, listen, I'll back my judgment 100%, he won't let you down. And I also said to you, I'll get you in the Premier League.
You did? No, I say it even now, and this is, you know, your name comes up quite regularly on these podcasts and in conversations because, yeah, it took me to Blackburn and I wouldn't have had a career. The thing is now as well, and this is another popular topic on this podcast, is like I look at it now and really, obviously you had my back then, and I'm only 5'11", 6 foot on a good day. You know what I mean? We used to measure me in the morning and try and add an inch onto Wikipedia where I could.
There was something I did with you which proved me right, that you don't have to be 6 foot two to come and catch crosses, because the power training I did with you twice a week, pre-season, once a week, all through your career with me, was made you jump, and you had the best spring I've seen. Mm.
It was the plyometric training. I always remember the drill, the sets of squats, followed by the drop jumps, followed by the hurdles, followed by the coach. No, I remember the drills. I do it when I coach. I do the bit of coaching now, and I still have the Hitchy handbook. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, because I did a lot of that with Robert Green. I did. And a great story when I went with Franco at West Ham was with Robert, who was the England goalkeeper at the time. And I showed him what I wanted him to do. And then I showed him someone letting a goal in. And I showed him why he let the goal in. And it was Van de Gaal.
Yeah, yeah.
Man United. And I showed Rob. And I wanted to work on this drill with Rob. And it took him ages and ages and ages to get it right, but he worked and worked and worked at it. We played Wigan at the end of the season, and he made this save in the top corner, fingertip, hit the bar, ball came out, went up there and we scored. And as we scored, he ran up to the dugout and jumped on me and said, I did it, I did it, I did it. And Franco's gone to me, he said, What's he done? What's he done? I said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's just between me and him.
Yeah, amazing. Well, do you know, I want to touch up. We're going to move on to the coaching side of things because, you know, we've had a few really good coaches on this. We've had Tony Parks, we've had Eric Steele. I mean, you've got several similar stories. You know, we were talking to Parks about the work he did with Gomez. And I mean, the amount of goalkeepers, I was talking to Matt before this podcast. Firstly, the amount of clubs that you've worked out and the amount of goalkeepers you've worked with. And even today, seeing the likes of, and I was saying to Matt, Matt didn't know that you did a lot of work with Neil Etheridge. You know,
big lot of work, yeah.
And I remember back then you telling me that he was one of the best around, and no one knew who he was, you know. But to see him come through the way he has, obviously Joe Hart. I mean, you can reel off a list of names. In fact, which clubs did you work for? I know several of them. You mentioned West Ham, obviously Watford, Blackburn.
Started at Watford, went to Blackburn.
Yeah.
Blackburn to Man City, Man City to Fulham.
Yeah.
Fulham to QPR. Mm-hmm. QPR to Qatar, West Ham in between.
Yeah.
QPR to Qatar, and then Qatar to Birmingham, and Birmingham. I went to India, which wasn't great, and that's it.
Wow.
So that time at Man City, you were there with Mark Hughes, and that similar to Chelsea in a way. That was when things were just starting to shift, and the money was coming in. Hughes was sacked with Roberto Mancini coming in, and you obviously left. With Hughes, but could you see at the time that they were on the cusp or something big?
Yeah. It was disappointing because if we'd have had more time and the resources what Roberto had, I have no doubt we would have done the same as him. No doubt at all. Because Mark Hughes is one of the top managers I've worked with, and watching and listening how he works with his staff is second to none. He should be at a top club.
So what do you think the reason is then with regards to Mark Hughes in the sense that he hasn't achieved or perhaps doesn't have the recognition from a lot of fans that perhaps he should do?
I can only go on the last three clubs he's been at. QPR was accident waiting to happen. Mark went in there with all these promises about bringing in players and they didn't really have the money. So they borrowed and it just went bang. They couldn't justify the needs. The recruitment side of it, which wasn't all Mark, I must say, I know for a fact, and the same thing happened at Stoke and at Southampton. I know while he was at Southampton that they had Fraser Foster, who had just signed a new contract, Stuart Taylor, who was on his way out, Alex McCarthy, who had come in and done really well, and then the club went and bought Angus Gunn. And Mark was told, in no uncertain terms, that it was his job to tell Fraser Foster that he's not going to be number one. And these things happen in football now. The modern football, it's not the managers, coaches who are bringing in the players, but they're the ones taking all the rap, should I say.
Well, that leads me into friendships in football because Neil Etheridge mentioned, to be fair, how the relationship he had with Neil Cutler was crucial in aiding his development. Now, in your case, if you look at ex-Chelsea teammates like Vialli, like Hughes, Steve Clarke, Gianfranco Zola, we've already mentioned, they've all taken you to the respective clubs that they've managed. Is football quite largely a case of who you know?
It helps, but also it's good to have friends like that, but you have to be good at your job to not let them people down. When you're a manager, you need a team around you who you can trust 100%, and you need someone who's got your back. And that's not what's happening at clubs now. I mean, Mark went to Stoke and he could only take two people in. Mark went to Southampton and he could only take two people in. Mm. And what you'll find is when things ain't going too well, everybody goes into little corners of their little departments and whisper. And it's not good for morale. It's not good for the players. But it happens. And I know for a fact that is happening at one of London's top clubs at the moment.
You mentioned there about having to be good at your job, which obviously you were, because these managers did continue to take you to the different clubs that they managed. And the record you had with the goalkeepers, obviously, I guess, starting at Watford, and you certainly helped me in a big way. And then going to Blackburn, you worked with the likes of Brad Friedel, you worked with Shay Given. Arguably, you worked with Joe Hart during the best period of his career, it's fair to say.
Yeah, and Kasper.
Yeah. How did you find, is there any who stick out in particular? And speaking of Joe Hart, because he is a popular topic on here and things have gone a little bit stale for him at the moment, what do you see the future for Joe Hart?
I believe Joe to be one of the top goalkeepers in England. And when things are going well, you can get carried away with things and forget about what got you to where you are, and then get distracted by outside issues. And I know Joe did a lot of adverts, and I thought, you don't need to be doing that. Just concentrate on your football. And I always say this to you as well when you was a young boy, because you always wanted to do other things. And all I wanted you to do was just concentrate on your football. Your football, your goalkeeping, your goalkeeper. 24/7. Because you remember when you first started your caps?
Yep.
No, I used to tell you off.
You
I
did.
Like your dad.
You did. No, do you know what? And it's actually...
Oh, this is very interesting. Okay.
Matt knows this because I said... You know, I mentioned earlier, like, my regrets in football are slightly different. It's... I think because of the way that my mind is, I always wanted to do different things. But the advice I give every goalkeeper that I work with now is the biggest investment you can do, forget any financial, the biggest investment you can do is in yourself. If you can focus on your game 24/7 until you're 35, then at that point, you can still have a period of time where if you want to go into something different, you want to go into coaching or business or whatever, you're going to have time to do that. But while you're playing, focus 100% on playing. And that's my biggest regret, is that as much as I love all the stuff I do now, and I know you joke to me off air that I'm doing everything, like, I love the stuff I do now, but when I was doing it while I was playing, it is impossible to give football 100%.
Exactly. And it's I remember having this conversation with it, and I bet when you finish, you think, you know what, he was bloody right, you know.
Yeah, I just don't like to admit it.
I know it's too late, but I used to have the same conversation with Neil. Neil Etheridge, when I was at Fulham with him, and I got there's a young one at Birmingham at the moment I had for a year, and I did exactly the same with him. I took him under my wing, and I'm looking after him still now. I got him an agent, and he's doing brilliant. His name's Conal Truman.
Truman, yeah.
He's going to be a good one, by the way.
Yeah, I like him. I've seen quite a lot of him. Yeah, very good.
Is it difficult, though, Kev, in defence of some of these younger players who are doing what they love, playing professional football, but also getting these external influences, and you know, it's quite nice to go to a glitzy event or get an advert for a bit of extra cash. Is it difficult to tell a young lad in his early 20s that he shouldn't be doing these things?
It's very difficult. I mean, it wasn't there for me when I did it, so I didn't have that distraction. And all I can say is, with my experience, please don't do it. It'll just take off what you're doing on the football. And I'll stick by that. Yeah, it's great, and players go out and they do it, and concentrate on the football. It will still be, if you're really good, they'll still want you.
Yeah. You went to Qatar, you went to India. Talk us through those experiences.
Qatar was all promises, none were delivered. And it was quite difficult. I mean, to work for a sheikh who's got more money than cents, should I say, and only paid the club if they played well or won. And if they didn't win, he didn't pay him.
Wow.
And there was a lot of turmoil, and there was a lot of things going on behind the scenes, which, to be fair, Franco hid from me because he knows how volatile I can be. There was a lot of politics involved, and the same with India. I mean, India's so new and it's getting bigger and bigger that they can't handle running a club professionally. You're fighting a losing battle all the time. And I went to India and we was promised like 5-star hotels. And because the season's got a little bit longer, they sort of skimped a little bit and put us in this accommodation, which was 1-star. And the food was -1-star. But I did lose weight.
That's a positive.
Does the culture differ there in terms of the changing room environment? Because we're obviously accustomed to a very specific environment here, and that's something that's been ingrained in football over many years.
Qatar was hard. I mean, they're all Muslims, and 5 minutes before kickoff, they all go and pray. They take their shoes and socks off and wash their feet and go and pray. And you're trying to do a team talk ready to go out before a game. Half time when you come in, they do the same again. They take their shoes and socks off and pray. And then you can have your team talk. It's strange. It didn't work. And it was very, very political. I mean, the league was the top four teams at 8 professionals. We were only allowed 4. And things like that. And you can't compete with. Like, our little Qatari boys were, you know, skinny, and these pros were like 6'4", full of muscle. And they just blew them over every game.
So just to finish on your playing career with Chelsea, Kev, 13 years in total, 135 appearances, 96 in the league. You were on the bench for cup finals in 94, 97, 98. You were also on the bench for the Cup Winners' Cup final in 1998. You were number 2 for the most part at Chelsea. How do you view that time looking back?
I wish I'd have played more. I had injuries at certain times in my career which stopped me from being the number one. I was close to getting an England call with Bobby Robson was the manager of England. I was close to getting an England call there. You know, that would have been fantastic. But do you know what? I look back on my career at Chelsea and I gave that club my life. And I'm proud of what I've done. I'm proud of who I've played with. I'm proud of how the supporters still perceive me as a Chelsea boy.
Obviously, being a number two for the period you were, do you think there's any part of that that, and observing the game in the way that you did, has helped your coaching?
100%. And working with different temperaments. Dimitri was quite hard, but in the end, he became a good friend. Me and Dave Besant, I mean, we looked after each other. And we'd play small-sided games, and me and him would want to be on the winning side. So we wanted the players to go, no, we want him in goal. We want him in goal. That's how we played.
Yeah. I'll always remember our games of head tennis. That was the Thursday morning head tennis and how competitive that got.
And I had Espen Barlsson.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a bit of an advantage, me and Chambo, when I think back. Well, look, what's a couple more questions. What's the next step, first and foremost? I know you're still keen to crack on with your coaching. You've been doing it now for as long as you have. I take it you're still keen to kick on for another few years?
Oh, 100%. I miss it. I mean, I'll try and improve anybody I'll come across, whether it be a young 7-year-old, a 14-year-old, or a top professional, international. It doesn't faze me. In fact, I prefer working with the top professionals. I mean, I went to Fulham and I had Mark Schwalzer. They just stopped him from going to Arsenal and he played up. Mark's a big boy and he does a lot of weights. But I pulled him and I said, you can't train like that. But I never disrespect my training sessions like you did today. I've got Neil Etheridge and David Stockdale working here and you're being an absolute shocker. And to be fair, I thought we was going to be coming to blows, but we didn't. And he worked really hard, Mark. He worked really hard under me. And I'd like to say I helped him get better as well.
Brilliant. And last question. We always ask every guest this, and it's interesting some of the answers we get. They've ranged from all sorts. But the question is, what has goalkeeping given you?
A career. It's given me a good career, given me knowledge and a love to improve other people. And I'll go back to when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was make saves.
You certainly made a few of them. In fact, I do remember coming over, obviously to your house back in the day a few times, and you've still got the stash of the old VHSs, and we went through a few videos. I still remember one save you made. It was across to the far post, and you've done the entire length of the goal, just thrown yourself full stretch. And
I did that every day in training.
Did you really?
That was, get it in the face, get it in the belly, anywhere, you know, as long as you catch it out of the goal. That was against Man City.
Yeah. I remember it well. I remember it well. And an interesting fact, in fact, this is more to tell Matt to tell this. Interesting fact, me and Kevin Hitchcock, we share the same birthday 20 years apart. So we just send each other a birthday text every year. That's kind of standard.
Yeah.
Well, on that note,
wonderful
stuff. Kev, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Kevin Hitchcock, mate. Enjoy that?
Yeah, loved it. I mean, obviously, I'm sure you could have gathered from the conversation. He's someone that I hold massively, such high regard for me. And I say it genuinely, he made me as a goalkeeper. You know, some great coaches before him, but a lot were part-time. Colin Barnes was very good in my youth team days. But him coming into Watford for me was huge because he had that belief in me. I had a lot of belief in him and his methods. And certainly he was able to adapt his training in such a way that really benefited me and my game. And he touched on the spring work that we would do, the power work that we would do. And I think he was quite ahead of his time in terms of his coaching methods. And of course, he had a fantastic career before that as well. To be at a club the size of Chelsea for as long as he was, he admitted himself he would have loved to have played a few more games. But, you know, look, I'm sure if you give most young goalkeepers that as a career, they certainly would have taken it. So no, great chat. He's got so many stories and I'm sure he's still got a lot to give to the goalkeeping world.
Okay, well, a keeper who's coming to the end of his career now is Aurelio Gomez, who had a good game at the weekend against Crystal Palace in the FA Cup. The scenes at the end were great with the tears.
Yeah,
shows how much it means to him. But the game itself was quite interesting, again, from an analysis perspective. And you know, this is quite a nice little part of the podcast where we analyse the analysis. But Jermaine Genus referenced one incident that we tweeted at the time, and It was from a corner. A ball had been headed down. Gomez made a decent save through a lot of bodies. Mm. And Jermaine Genus says, he's seen it all the way. I think he'll enjoy the picture of it rather than the save. What are your thoughts?
I could just copy and paste what I say every week. Maybe that's what we do. Because there's a lot of things going on in that save. You know, you touch on, we've seen the photos on the GK Union Twitter page where it has come through bodies. So you can't make your decision straight away. As soon as the ball's headed, ordinarily you can dive to make the save. You can't make the dive at that point because you have to wait until it's gone past the defender, past the strikers, because it could take a deflection, at which point you make the reaction. How many times have we seen it, for instance, where a free kick will come in from wide and end up going in the corner and no one touches it? And it's because the goalkeeper might get put off by the people that are in the box. So you've got to make so many decisions in a split second, which Gomez did perfectly in order to spring to his right and get the ball away. But of course, if you don't have understanding of goalkeeping, then all you see is a header, a reasonably weak header, a goalkeeper diving and doing a big parry. But of course, when you're in the position he's in and you are on terrestrial TV, or, you know, on Sky, whatever you're on, you have to talk about all positions. You have to talk about goalkeepers, because if you don't, goalkeepers won't get talked about because there's not goalkeeping analysts. So of course, look, it's absolutely fine and people are welcome to their opinions, but they're always going to be basic opinions if they don't understand the position.
Okay, well, in that same game, Vicente Guaita as well had quite an erratic performance. He made some decent saves, which were referenced, but seemed to, don't like to use the word, flap at crosses. That was picked up as well. It was a very windy day. He had a good game. But what are your thoughts on him coming into Palace and this weekend in particular?
Yeah, I mean, look, we saw the best of him and the worst of him. Certainly a couple of the saves he made, the one up in the top corner, the speed and spring was phenomenal. Do you know what? I see some similarities between him and Sergio Rico, and I think it's because they're coming from a different game, a different culture, that it is a difficult game to adapt to. And you can see he doesn't look comfortable on crosses. The conditions were really poor yesterday. Doesn't matter what stadium you're playing in. It was so wet and windy. It was always going to be a tough game for goalkeepers. The problem is with a lot of the crosses, and there's an old cliche, which is, you know, if you come, you've got to go all the way. Well, that's not always necessarily true, but I felt that was the case with him yesterday, where he's come for a couple that he wasn't getting anywhere near, but you could see that once he'd committed, he went the entire way, but he didn't get near the cross. And we saw it with David De Gea when he first came here. It can be very difficult getting used to the style of football that we play in England, in the Premier League or FA Cup in this matter. So what will end up happening, or what should happen, is that he will need to do some more work on that at the training ground. The majority of his game, 95%, is very, very good. But of course, the moment their team sees that he struggles on crosses, like has happened with Sergio Rico in the last few weeks, unsurprisingly, other teams are now putting every cross on Sergio Rico. They will start putting every cross on Guaita.
You mentioned Sergio Rico there, and we're going to delightfully segue into the Fulham goalkeeper, because that's exactly what Liverpool did this weekend. They lumped a whole load of crosses right on top of him in what should have been a 1-1 draw, but it turned out to be a 2-1 win for Liverpool, and that was primarily because Rico gave away and then conceded a penalty. We'll get onto that one, but first we'll talk about the Fulham equaliser from Ryan Babel, which was a 50-50 with Alisson, as a result of a weak header back from Virgil van Dijk. But it caused a bit of reaction, initially on commentary by Jamie Carragher, who said that Alisson needed to be more aggressive. In the studio, Tim Cahill said it was blatant, said the keeper has to deal with it, he's got to pick the ball up. He did back that up by saying, obviously, Virgil van Dijk could have headed it right, but maybe Alisson should have stood up and held both his hands up and looked Babel in the eyes and maybe taken one in the face. Graeme Souness likewise said, why is he not taking a blow for the cause? Why is he going with his feet? He said, you'll have to ask him that. Well, we can't ask Alisson. So I'm going to ask you, what are your thoughts?
I think a lot of goalkeepers will have had this situation before, where the moment the ball's headed back, the reason it isn't quite as simple as him just picking it up is, consider this. If he thinks that Ryan Babel's going to get there before he gets there, then his actions are going to be very different as opposed to just picking up the ball. He's going to look to spread and make the save. My thinking is that as soon as the ball's headed back, and it was a weak header from Van Dijk, so first and foremost, I think they've touched on that, obviously, in the commentary, that it was a mistake from Van Dijk. Didn't get the header how he wanted to get the header, which then made it very difficult for Alisson, because then all of a sudden, it becomes more of a one-on-one as opposed to him just picking up the ball. So he thinks that Babel's going to get there. Alisson thinks Babel's going to get there before him, so he spreads as opposed to go and pick up the ball. Now, had he just gone to pick up the ball and Babel gets a touch, the chances are then Alisson brings him down, Alisson gets a red card, etc., etc. So I fully understand exactly why Alisson's done what he's done. again, it's, you know, I know we love the whole black and white, is it an error, isn't it an error? You know, you watch it again, and in hindsight, his decision is wrong because he could have picked it up, but it's such a split-second decision. He's made the decision to spread as opposed to pick up the ball because he thinks Ryan Babel's getting there first. I think it's as simple as that. I don't think it's got anything to do with bravery. That'll be the one thing that's labelled against him in a situation like this. I think it's simply that he's slightly misjudged it, and he thinks it's a one-on-one situation that Babel's going to get there ahead of him, as opposed to what actually happened, where, in hindsight, he could have picked up the ball.
So that made it 1-1. Looked like Fulham might have got something out of the game. Massive game in the title race. Until he then concedes the penalty. Tame effort from Mo Salah. It was a tame effort. Rico looked like he could have caught it. He decided to pat it down. Sadio Mane intervened. He's instinctively grabbed him and conceded the penalty.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, he's having a tough time at the moment, Sergio Rico. We have touched on this on previous podcasts. And I think this situation summed it up in some ways. I think it's a mixture of a lack of confidence, but also the decision making at this particular time wasn't particularly good. Now, this also, for me, is where we see goalkeepers parrying more and more as goalkeeping's developing. But I think it's a great example as to why, as much as you parry a football, being able to hold the football and have the technique to hold the football is still vitally important. Now, a lot of goalkeepers do, and they call it a soft parry, where, let's say it's a shot from 30 yards and it's coming around your chest. You might do a soft parry down into the ground, take the sting off the ball, and get it on the second attempt. That's absolutely fine when no one's around you. And sometimes it's quite a good technique to do to, rather than risk the ball slipping through your hands, just to pat it into the ground. However, when it's as close as this and you've got players around you, your handling needs to be spot on. And you could tell that the shot was taken. It wasn't a particularly fair shot. Yes, the conditions weren't brilliant for this particular game. But this is where, again, it either needs to be a big parry wide, which wouldn't have suited this situation because it was too close into him. So this is where you need to trust your hands. You need to have brilliant hands and just grab that ball. And you do that. And as you say, it likely finishes 1-1. Then the decision making afterwards is a panic. You know, as soon as he's dropped the ball and he realises that he's not going to get there, it's a panic and he grabs the player and, of course, gives away the penalty, and it ends up being another frustrating afternoon for him and for Fulham, unfortunately.
And lastly, to finish off what was quite an eventful weekend for goalkeepers, we are sadly saving the worst till last. Don't like to say it, but poor old David Martin. Millwall about 10 seconds from reaching an FA Cup semi-final. Brighton, their opponents, get a free kick late in injury time. Solly March swings it in. It seems like all David Martin has to do is catch it. He misreads it completely, misjudges it completely. The game then goes to penalties. Brighton obviously win. David Martin doesn't manage to save a single spot kick. Tough one. A very, very tough one.
Yeah, really tough. I felt so sorry for David Martin in this situation. Just a horrible, horrible position and moment for a goalkeeper. And again, goalkeepers listening in, I'm sure when we saw that go in, our heart just sank with him. And the way I can explain it is this, is that he hasn't played a great deal of football. In fact, he played during the week, played against Birmingham in a 2-0 win, did very well. But that's the first game he's played this season. So this is only the second game that he's played all season. Obviously, ordinarily, it's Jordan Archer. Ben Amos as well was playing largely earlier in the season. But interestingly, they played David Martin. Ben Amos was on the bench. And up until that point, he had had an excellent game. He made several very good saves, a couple of really tricky balls in the first half that he dealt with, good save down to his low in the second half, and you thought he was going to be something of a hero. And this is where the situation has played a massive part. The fact that it is the last minute, it's 10 seconds to go. The conditions were dreadful this weekend, we know that. The ball's whipped in, and you could almost see his decision-making process as the ball's in flight. He's thinking, do I catch it? But it's slippy, it's wet. Maybe catching it isn't the best thing to do. Do I put it over the bar? Do I parry it wide? Do I punch it? And in the end, it's a mixture of all four, really. It doesn't really end up doing anything, and it almost goes through his hands. Whereas if only he could have just parried it wide or pushed it over the bar. I think in hindsight, given the conditions, that might have been one where you almost just parry it for a corner. You know, it might not look great, might not look pretty, but you get it around the post and it allows you then to regroup and defend the corner as a team rather than having that ball on you as an individual. But I just felt dreadful for him. I've had moments myself similar. And to do it in obviously such a big moment will be heartbreaking for him. You know, it's been a tough season, hasn't played much. And I hope for his sake that he's able to move on from this, because again, loads of positives to take from the game. He's had a very, very good career and will continue to have a very good career. But yeah, this was a very tough moment for David Martin, and of course, a very tough moment for Millwall.
Right, mate, this week's Keeper Capers, quite an extraordinary turn of events because this isn't something we often see that much in football these days, but twice in 1 week we've seen that unbelievable incident where a player lurks behind a goalkeeper, the keeper drops the ball completely unaware the player is there and nicks the ball in front of him. Now, there's two examples. The first one, Carlisle v Notts County. Hallam Hope was lurking on the goal line for ages for Carlisle. Ryan Schofield, the Notts County goalkeeper, eventually put the ball down. Hope intervened. Goal. And then this weekend, Wigan v Bolton, Remy Matthews had comfortably held a Michael Jacobs cross. Jacobs then lingered with intent, but it was quite obvious. Matthews seemed to look right at him. He put the ball down. Jacobs intercepts, rolls it to Nick Powell. Goal. Mm. I mean, how does this happen?
It's intriguing that we've had two in the same week. And you often see this. I mean, it's sort of related, so I'll mention it, but the pitch invasions. You know, you suddenly get one and you get a handful. And then we've seen, obviously, a few in the last week. And it's the same with this, where I just wonder, because it hasn't happened for so long. Now, what I would say is if you put yourself in the goalkeeper's shoes, you have a quick glance round, but it's always a very quick glance. It's not like they have a real look. It's almost like a very quick look. And a player, certainly in Remy Matthews' case, as he's turned round, there's every chance that that player he's seeing could be a fan sat in the crowd. If you're not looking for quickly enough, you'll see the colour of their shirt, but that's about it. And it'll be mixed in with the thousands of shirts in the stadium. So you're not necessarily going to register it, you know, and also you don't expect it. That's the other thing. I don't think, for all the games I've played, there's probably only once that someone's actually done that and actually lingered behind me and waited for me. So it's almost like driving a car. It's something you know you have to do. You have to check your rear view mirrors, or you have to check alongside you your blind spot. You have to check. 99 times out of 100, there's nothing there, but that one time in 100, there is someone there. Hence why you have to check, and you have to check properly. Just on Remy Matthews, because I do feel for him, because he's been in scintillating form for Bolton in the past few weeks, and certainly reading a lot of the reports on him, he's been their man of the match, I think, five or six games in a row. So no doubt this will hurt him, and it was obviously a heavy defeat, and it's a real unfortunate error to make.
This does then defeat the object of the check. If you're saying that he might have confused the player with someone in the crowd, I mean, come on, he's checking. So if you're going to check, you've got to see the player.
I agree. And I use that analogy of the blind spot, because I think it's one of them. You're taught it when you learn to drive. Look for your blind spot. But you can get lazy. And sometimes you might move into another lane and think, do you know what, I haven't actually properly checked there. And you might just get lucky. And ordinarily, the chances are you are going to get lucky. And the more that you get lucky, the more that you do a half-hearted check, you put the ball down and kick it and no one does anything, the less seriously you check every single time. And it's like anything. If it's not happened to you before, then you're not going to expect it to happen. So what it will serve as is a nice warning for goalkeepers up and down the land, Sunday league goalkeepers to professional goalkeepers, that this is becoming a thing again, because you know the strikers will be watching this and they will be replicating this, whether that's in Sunday league, professional, semi-professional. So for goalkeepers, be on high alert, because strikers are going to be doing this, you know, so be on high alert, because they're likely to do this to you now, and make sure that you do check properly.
I have to say as well that while I don't think I can defend goalkeepers in this instance, it does surprise me, it baffles me that, I mean, that Carlisle incident, Notts County, he was there for ages, like ages on the goal line. Surely at some point, a player or a fan, teammate has got to turn around and say, dude, there's a guy behind you.
That's the one though, right? Because like Remy Matthews, it's an away game. So of course, the fans aren't going to give away the game, are they? So the fans are going to stay quiet. I believe the game was at Carlisle, between Carlisle and Notts County. So again, it's an away game. There are no fans anywhere near him to tell him. You can imagine the fans at the other end of the ground screaming as loud as they can.
So what about teammates though?
I mean, consider the situation. Well, some are and some aren't. I mean, consider the situation. By that time, they'll have made their way upfield. They'll have turned round. They're probably not that focused on what's going on behind him either. All they're looking at is the ball and waiting for the ball to be fired up so they can win the header. So a lot of them won't see him. Even if they did, they might be 50, 60 yards away from him. So as much as they're screaming, Ryan, Remy, as much as they're screaming that, the goalkeepers might not necessarily hear them. And the other part of it is, again, put yourself in the goalkeeper's shoes. You're thinking about your distribution. So you're thinking, right, get the ball down, make sure we get a nice strike, hit a certain area. You are not then thinking about who stood behind you. And even if a defender's screaming at you, you may well block it out, because that's not important right now. What's important is that you get a good connection on the ball.
Well, that is another showdown, mate.
It is indeed.
Enjoy it.
It's been fantastic. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Great hearing so much about you from Mr. Hitchcock.
Yeah, many stories and said a couple of nice words. A few things I didn't know, by the way, just on that note, mentioning the fact that when I made my debut, there was a few of the coaches that weren't so sure. I might have to give them a call.
Brilliant. Well, look, we're going to end this with a little shout out to The Art of Goalkeeping. Now, this is a website dedicated to the celebration of football goalkeepers, past and present, spearheaded by a gentleman called Doug Nash, who's a big fan of ours, tweets us occasionally, and did send us in an email of your fine self, an absolutely cracking illustration.
It was a spitting image.
This will go on our Twitter, so the listeners will see it.
Excellent. They're in for a treat. It was a very good. It was a really good illustration, actually. Very clever.
But the great thing about this is that he does a whole bunch of illustrations. And if you go on the website, I mean, it's quite unbelievable, really. There's pretty much every goalkeeper that you could ever have imagined to have played football. And I believe he does custom-made illustrations as well. So if you're a Sunday League goalkeeper or a non-league goalkeeper or whatever level you're at, he will do an illustration of you or a friend. Great birthday present.
Sounds fantastic. Perfect for every goalkeeping enthusiast.
Absolutely. Now, just to let people know, that is theartofgoalkeeping.com. As always, if there's anything you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, it's easy to let us know. On Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official, just search GK Union or Facebook, or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon.